Blog Talk Radio.
Here we are. This week, the Obama administration finds some cojones and finally sues Arizona. A preliminary investigation is underway in California into allegations that Mel Gibson committed domestic violence against his former girlfriend. I find these allegations hard to believe. He's not a wife beater. He's just a racist, anti-Semitic, drunken pig. First-time jobless claims are down again, and stocks went up again. The Emmy Award nominations have been announced in Hollywood. In an unprecedented occurrence, a nomination has been made for the producer of the LeBron James announcement show that hasn't aired yet for figuring out how to fill an hour on the show where James is set to announce where he's going to play next year. A federal judge in Massachusetts rules that the federal law interfering with gay and lesbian marriage is unconstitutional. But wait, it's not as good as it seems. West Virginia's attorney general rules that the governor has the legal authority to call a special election to fill Robert Byrd's seat. But that's not the problem, Governor. And hey, do you have elective surgery to schedule? Don't go in July. We'll tell you why. Speaking of Emmy nominations, and we were, one interesting show received four nominations. The Tonight Show with Conan O'Brien. China has bought a record amount of Japanese government bonds. This may just be the sleeper story of the day, and by that I don't mean that hearing the story will make you want to sleep. Stay tuned for this one, and no jokes about one from column A and another from column B. By the way, this might also be a reason that the stock market went up today. Iran has announced that a woman who was sentenced to death by stoning for committing adultery will in fact not be stoned to death. For her crime, she's already spent 5 years in jail and received 99 lashes by a whip. They didn't say she wouldn't be executed, just that it won't be by stoning. What a wonderful, civilized country. Larry King and his seventh wife have filed papers to dismiss the divorce for which they both filed. This poor guy, even his divorce gets canceled. Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. That would be moi. All that and news of the weird, along with our guest, author Morgan St. James, to talk about Silver Sisters Mysteries, among other works and topics. But first, our book, Mobile Millionaire, has a site, and you should go look at it and read an excerpt. The website is easy to find. It's mobilemillionaire, one word, .blogspot.com. The book deals with investment in mobile homes for wealth and income and how you can do it with little or no money without paying us anything extra after you buy the book. Anyway, welcome to the show. I wanted to thank all of you for joining us again, our audience, which we have a way of checking. We're not able to tell who's tuning in, but we're able to tell how many people are tuning in, and more of you are. So thank you for that, and let me give you our number to call in if you'd like to add your voice to anything we're talking about or perhaps something we're not. The only reservation or limitation we ask is you don't call and quote any religious works like the Bible or the Quran or any of those other books. Anyway, the phone number is 347-994-3796. Repeating, 347-994-3796. As you know, by the way, they did make a movie a number of years ago called The Bible. And I was going to say, I don't know if it ever made it to DVD, but probably has. I don't know if they've ever made a book called The Quran. And I'm kind of waiting for that to come to a theater or drive-in near me. And actually, where we are, they actually do have a couple of drive-ins, believe it or not. I don't think there are a lot of places in the country that still do have those. Anyway, we spoke at the top. The Obama administration is actually suing the state of Arizona over the law passed by the state called SB 1070. Pardon me. And the SB 1070 is the law that requires police to determine someone's immigration status if they are stopped or being questioned for any other reason. It doesn't give the police officers any discretion. They have to find out. And as a matter of fact, many people don't know this, but if a local police department isn't, by some people's lights, handling this in the right way, if they're not sufficiently enforcing it, any individual can bring a lawsuit against that city's police department. So they are obviously going to try to enforce that once the law goes into effect. But the Obama administration has sued through the Justice Department, and they are asking the federal district court to what's called enjoin, that is to stop the law from taking effect. Now, they're not doing it because the law may involve racial profiling and therefore be a civil rights violation. They're not doing it because it's stupid, which it obviously is. They are asking the federal court to enjoin the enforcement of Arizona's law because it usurps federal government power. And the reason it usurps government power is because under the Constitution, it is the federal government that is supposed to have charge of things like immigration. The fact that the federal government hasn't done much of a job in this area is acknowledged, but is really beside the point. If, in fact, the federal government has that power and chooses not to exercise it, that doesn't mean that the states, according to that argument, which I agree with, it doesn't mean that the states can then go ahead and create their own immigration law. And one can understand why that's an appropriate province for the federal government. Pardon me. If it is any other way, if Arizona's law is allowed to stand, who's to say that Minnesota or Texas or California won't pass their own immigration laws? And in fact, one state at least, Kansas, did, and other states have been talking about it. I mentioned Texas. They've also been talking about a law that would cause them to secede from the country. But just on the immigration subject, you could theoretically have 50 different immigration laws if each state were allowed to pass their own and put it into effect. That's what the federal lawsuit's about. And I believe that arguments for the injunction are due to be heard next week. I'm not sure of that. But if the injunction is successful, whoever wins that case, it's going to be appealed. My only concern is that when it gets before the U.S. Supreme Court with its present structure, with its present membership, anything could happen. But at the very least, it does appear that the state's enforcement of the law will be stopped. And yes, I can hear all of you cheering. Thank you very much. I'm not the cause of it. We don't need to talk about Mel Gibson anymore. First-time jobless claims are down. They've gone up a couple of times. They were expected to go down. They went down more than expected. So that's a good thing. That is, there are fewer people being laid off, fired, etc. That's good for the economy. Also, between our last show and this one, it hit the news that factory owners have been adding jobs since the beginning of the year, giving a lift to the economy. And because they laid off so many workers, more than 2 million since the end of 2007, their biggest problem is that although they have a vast number of people to choose from, they are unable to fill the openings because they don't have any, the people who are available don't really have the skills. So that's become a problem. And that is a problem when you lay people off and then try to get people back, not necessarily those same people, but try to hire people. Very often you find that the skills that you got rid of are just no longer out there, and you end up having to train all those people again. So if there's a choice, if you're an employer and you have a choice, don't lay off skilled people. Fire a politician instead. Anyway, but I mentioned the stock market went up today, and I'd like to suggest to you that that may not be the reason. The financial pundits all day have been talking about the great jobs report being the reason for the stock market going up. I don't believe that's right, or at least if it is right, it's not the whole answer, and we'll get to that in a minute when we start talking about China and Japan. In the meantime, in Massachusetts, a federal judge, this was at the district court level, that's the first court you go to in the federal system. It's district court, and then if you appeal from that, you go to, generally speaking, you go to the Circuit Court of Appeals, and then the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court is not required to take any case that is offered to it, but that is the structure, that's the hierarchy of the federal courts. In any event, a judge in Massachusetts essentially ruled that the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, which was passed and sponsored to a large extent by Bill Clinton, but it was passed by Congress and he signed it, interferes with states' rights. Here's basically the way this is set up. Massachusetts allows for either civil union or, in fact, homosexual marriage. I'm not sure which. But the challenge was to the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, which was passed in 1996, because prior to that federal law passing, for years, centuries in fact, what constitutes a marriage has been a province of the state's governments. Each state can determine for itself, under tradition and history, who can get married there. The bad part about that, if you take it back to before the Civil Rights period, that each state, having its own right to determine what the legal marriage is, could have, and in many cases did, determine that you couldn't have two people from different ethnicities or races marry each other. That was ultimately outlawed in a federal Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court case, in which the party's name was Love. But that aside, what we have now in Massachusetts is a decision that says, yeah, Defense of Marriage Act, which essentially says two things. Number one, legal marriage is man-woman. And secondly, and this is the weird part about the Defense of Marriage Act, no state has to recognize a marriage which occurs in another state if it interferes with the first state's laws. So what the Defense of Marriage Act says, among other things, is assuming you can get legally married if you're talking about two men or two women, you can get legally married in Massachusetts, but Arizona doesn't have that. Here comes Arizona again. And so you go to Arizona. Arizona doesn't have to recognize your marriage. Okay? Well, the reason that's particularly odd is outside the constitutionality issue about state versus federal, is the Constitution of the United States says, among other things, that each state has to give full faith and credit to the laws of other states. This was a compromise reached when the Constitution was being created following the rather checkered history of the Articles of Confederation. This is not a history class, but a reminder to you of that which you already know, I hope. In any event, the Defense of Marriage Act would seem to fly in the face of the Full Faith and Credit Clause of the U.S. Constitution, but that's not what was being argued essentially today. What was being argued, or what was decided today by the Massachusetts Federal Court, which was that the Defense of Marriage Act interferes with the right of the state of Massachusetts to determine for itself and the Commonwealth, I should say the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, they call themselves a Commonwealth rather than a state, can rule for themselves and for their residents what constitutes a legal marriage. So that's the situation there. By the way, we have about 10 minutes before we're joined by Morgan St. James. If you'd like to join us at that point or prior, you can do so at 347-994-3796. We mentioned the West Virginia situation. Senator Robert Byrd, age 92, died last week, and the result is that there's one less Democrat in the Senate than there was before. West Virginia's governor has a couple of options. He can appoint someone to fill the seat. And by the way, the governor of West Virginia is also a Democrat. Or he can hold a special election. Or, and this is the interesting part, he could do both. So far, he has hesitated to name anyone, but he has said that if there's a special election, he will probably run for the seat himself. What he should be doing, frankly, is appointing himself now and running for the seat in the special election. That way, another Democrat would be in the Senate, and the Democrats who are in the Senate, in terms of passing extended unemployment benefits and in the sense of the financial regulation reform they're trying to get passed, wouldn't have to be such wusses in terms of giving the Republicans all the things that they want in order to get legislation passed. So right now, the biggest problem is with the West Virginia governor, and he's apparently hesitant to appoint himself. He could appoint his wife, he could appoint anybody, but he needs to appoint a Democrat, and soon. Elective surgery. In the month of July, Fatal medication errors, according to a UC San Diego report that just came out, fatal medication errors go up 10% in July in hospitals throughout the country. Now, if you're like me, and of course you're not, but it, nonetheless, you might ask, why July? And the first thing that occurs is, okay, it's hot outside, everybody's miserable, including the doctors and the nurses, and they come in and they're miserable, and they're grouchy, so they make mistakes. That's not it. What happens is each June, medical schools graduate their new doctors, and many of them are starting internships and residencies. And because July is their first month on, fatal medication errors have been going up every July. So not necessarily from year to year, but within the year, each July fatal medication errors are increased. There was some conversation around and about today that the Emmy Award nominations for Conan O'Brien when he was hosting The Tonight Show might be a way of the voters slapping NBC for the way they treated him. But in fact, that show did receive four nominations, including the nomination for Best Variety Show, whatever it's called. That's not the exact wording. In more important news than The Tonight Show, today, we mentioned it a few minutes ago at the top, China, I'm not sure it was today, it may have been over the last few days, China has purchased a record amount of Japanese government bonds. This is what may be a very big story, but it was treated like nothing. It was on the financial pages, but nowhere else. This did not, at least all of the outlets that I've checked through the day, this was not a big story anywhere. But I think it may very well be a big story, and here's why. Government bonds are a government's promise to pay back the purchase price of the bond plus interest at a certain rate. The fewer people who want to buy your bonds, the higher interest you have to pay. This begins to get a little bit complicated, but if they are buying more Japanese government bonds, what might they buy less of? Anyone? Okay, right. They might buy less United States government bonds. Now, they have already started buying fewer bonds that are euro-denominated. But if they stop buying U.S. government bonds, this could mean that our debt has to be paid at a much higher rate of interest. That could have a serious negative effect on the U.S. economy. Okay, smart guy, if that's true, you're probably saying now to me, why did the stock market go up? They're not any less smart than you are. They are certainly not less smart than I am. But the reason the stock market could well have gone up is this. Investors, at the risk of saying the obvious, have to put their money someplace. So where do they put them? Well, most savvy investors divide their money among several investments, but from day to day or week to week, they'll make decisions based on what they think is going to go up. Here's the problem. When bonds cannot be easily sold, we're talking about government bonds at the moment, then the interest rate that the government has to offer to sell those bonds has to be higher, lower, or the same? Higher, right. What happens is they have to offer more money for the bonds. But what happens when that is about to occur is the prices of existing bonds that you could buy today go down. Why is that? Well, I'm glad I asked that question. Now I'll answer it. Is if, let's say, for example, I could buy a $1,000 bond paying 10%, these numbers are completely made up, but if I could buy a $1,000 bond today for 10% and the interest rates on new bonds about to be issued next Thursday or some other nearby time is what I'm trying to say. If the interest rate is likely to be higher, the bonds that I or someone else already owns, that is, that have already been issued, become worth less because I can take that same $1,000. Let's assume that the interest rate were going to stay at 10%. That same bond would still be worth $1,000. But if interest rates on new bonds are going to go up, the value of the current bond becomes lower because then someone could buy let's assume it's going to go up to 15%, again, just to use a silly figure. Someone, instead of getting $100 in a year for that $1,000, is now going to be able to get $150. Well, in order to get that same rate of interest on my bond that I own, that I paid $1,000 for at a 10% level, I have to pay, I can't figure out the math, I'll let you do that, but I'm going to have to sell that at a much lower price. Okay, if bond prices are as a result down, or I think they're going to go down because interest rates are going to be increased on the government bonds, I have to put my money someplace, and very often the same people who invest in bonds invest in stocks. There's a lot of traffic back and forth in money among those investors, since bonds and stocks are both traded on an open market and on an exchange. So if they're not buying bonds because they think bonds are going to go down, they invest in stocks. What happens with stocks when more people want to buy? The value of the stocks go up. That's what happened today. The market went up on the same day that it was announced that China was buying a great deal of Japanese debt. You may think that's coincidence. I don't. We talked about Iran denying the old song. Was it Dylan who sang Everybody Must Get Stoned? Okay, denying the old Dylan song. Thankfully, the woman who has been convicted of adultery will not be stoned to death. Isn't that lovely? Every week we try to offer you, we may not have a lot of time for it because we're expecting the call from Morgan in a minute, but every week we try to bring you news of the weird, and we obtain that from a site that I recommend to you. There are two. There's just newsoftheweird.com, and for the real diehard cynic, there's newsoftheweird.blogspot.com. We've got a few stories. Let me just cover one or two with you. This comes from their site. The comments, of course, are mine. In what they call an undignified death, in which we couldn't disagree, a 38-year-old motorist was killed near Okeechobee, Florida, when a portable potty being hauled on a truck in front of her broke free, sending a big chunk through her windshield. Now, I hate to make fun of the dead.
Of course you do.
But if she hadn't died in the accident, she might have been arrested for drunk driving. Because after all, she was driving while, well, bleep-faced. In any event, in Mesa... Here is a really weird story. Researchers in the National Federation of the Blind have announced a prototype car that can be driven by people who are sightless without any other human being present in the car. Basically, it involves sensors and so forth. But it makes me concerned and makes me wonder what will happen if the electrical system goes out while they're driving. I don't know about you, but I can tell you that's happened in cars that I've driven. And I just don't think this is an enormously great idea. In what doesn't seem like a related story, in Mesa County, Colorado, a motorist was not seriously hurt, but she was forced to drive her SUV off the road and into a canal, she said, because a vampire suddenly appeared. Now, this makes perfect sense if you think about it. If the blind can drive a car, why can't people who see things that aren't there? See, it's kind of a reciprocal thing. Okay. Anyway, we're going to be joined in a minute by Morgan St. James. I recommend that you stick with us for that. It should be an interesting conversation. Next week on the show, we have the return of a guest that you folks have told me is a favorite of yours, Larry Hancock. Larry is the writer of the books relating to the Kennedy assassination. We've talked about the assassinations before. I'm hopeful we'll do that again, although next week, we are scheduled to have more of a political discussion, which will be basically talking about views and opinions about budget and taxation. We have some similar ideas and also some very different ideas for one another, and we thought you folks might find that interesting. You'll find out next week whether we were right, and you can join us. And that week in particular, since we are going to be talking about politics, if you'd like to join us, again, you're more than welcome. Tonight, the number is 347-994-3796. We haven't scheduled it yet, and if she's listening to this, she's going to be not surprised, but perhaps surprised I'm mentioning it before we set it up. But Sabella Giarello was on with us, was it last week or the week before? I don't remember, but it was the week before last. And we ended up talking less about her books than about politics. And she and I talked afterwards, and we're going to have her join us again as well, though we don't have a date on that. And also coming up in a future show, we're going to be talking to a writer whose publication has been solely in the form of a Kindle-ready book. No hard copy, not available any other way on the Internet or anything, just as a Kindle book. And we will have her talk to us about how that was done for all of you folks who want to write a book. By the way, feel free not to call me or send me an email and say, I've got a great idea for a book. I say that as a joke, but it's amazing to me how many people either do in fact have or believe they have a great idea for a book, but don't feel that they can write it. Let me urge you, in fact, to sit down at the computer or a typewriter, if you're old-fashioned, and start writing. Anyway, another item while we're waiting for Morgan, another item from the News of the Weird, Lake Como Park in Fort Worth, Texas. The park pool in Fort Worth, Texas, has a brand-new parking lot consisting of 16 spaces. It was built with government funds, of course, with a price tag of $37,000. Unfortunately, there's not going to be a lot of use for it until next year at the earliest, because the pool is closed indefinitely for cost-cutting, and they knew this when they built the parking lot. So your tax dollars at work. Speaking of that, President Obama is going around the country talking about the stimulus package, and in fact you can see some differences it's making in various places around the country, and we can talk more about that if you care to join us. But for now, I believe we are joined by Morgan St. James. Are you there?
I am certainly here.
Okay, welcome. Morgan is the co-author of a comical mystery series called The Silver Sisters Mysteries, which she writes with her sister Phyllis Bradner. One of these books, A Corpse in the Soup, was named Best Mystery Audiobook in 2007 by USA Book News. And there's another one, The Seven Deadly Samovars, which finds them tracking two bumbling Russian thugs from Juneau, Alaska, to Seattle, and then to L.A. The third book, called Vanishing Act in Vegas, is being edited and will be released in 2011. Morgan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy. I was going to say I'm happy to have you here, but it may be misunderstood.
I upstaged you. I stepped on your line.
You wouldn't be the first. Morgan also has had some short stories appear in a number of anthologies, including one series that I'm sure you're all familiar with, at least by having heard of it, which is Chicken Soup for the Soul. How did you get involved with that?
Well, I had a couple of stories. Both of them actually had been recognized in Writer's Digest contests.
Uh-huh.
And the first one that I did was about my mother, who had experienced many strokes and had dementia. And
yeah,
it was the last time I took her shopping. And it was a very touching story because the fellow at the May Company, when she said, well, I'm not sure I can dance in these shoes, he took her around and danced her all over the shoe department, which was lovely. And, in fact, the editors on that book said that when they read it, it could have been any one of their mothers, and they decided to use it as the first story in Chicken Soup for the Shopper's Soul.
How nice.
Yeah, the second one, the book title is Chicken Soup for the Soul, Celebrating People Who Make a Difference. And some people that I've written about for the last 10 or 15 years have made a difference in over 2,000 children's lives. So I felt that they definitely belonged in that book and contacted my editor from the previous one. And these people work with an equestrian vaulting program and have created miracles where children have been able to get up from wheelchairs and walk. And
really?
They're just totally amazing. They've been...
What's the name of that organization?
It's Valley View Vaulters, and
okay,
they're in Lakeview Terrace, California.
I remember Lakeview Terrace.
You what?
I say I remember Lakeview Terrace. I used to live near there.
Oh, yes. Well, they're right on, I want to say Osborne, but it isn't Osborne. But you can see them from the 210 freeway rehearsing with the kids. And what equestrian vaulting is mm-hmm. Gymnastics on moving horses.
Wow.
And they do them in teamwork. And as I say, what they've accomplished with these children and young adults is nothing short of amazing.
And I want to talk about your writing in a minute, but these are essentially all disabled kids that they're helping through
well,
this program?
Well, what they've done, because the coach himself lost his arm and shoulder to cancer when he was only 11 mm-hmm. years old, and I don't recall whether it was his father or his grandfather. You know, obviously 11 years old and you lose your arm and shoulder, that's not an easy thing to deal with. And he said to him, look, Ricky, you've got a choice. You can spend the rest of your life feeling sorry for yourself, or you can be the best you can be at what you choose to do. And he chose to be the best he could be and help others.
Mm-hmm.
And so he became a medalist in a two-armed sport and
wow.
is considered one of the foremost vaulting coaches in the country. So
okay.
maybe that's a topic for another show.
Yeah, no, that is
that
interesting.
Would be
no,
great
that's great
for you.
Yeah. So you wrote a story about those folks.
Yes,
that
it's
was
called "Measuring Miracles by Leaps and Bounds."
That's great, and that appeared also in one of the Chicken Soul books.
Yes,
Chicken
uh-huh.
Soul. Chicken. I have a chicken soul, but that refers
to
chicken
soup. Not in
the way
of your eye teeth, huh?
Yeah, usually the most amusing things that happen on this show is when the host makes a stupid mistake.
All the time. Maybe I can.
Yeah, you can co-host someday then.
Spread
you
the blame there.
There you go. So tell us about the Silver Sisters.
Well, the Silver Sisters are so much fun for Phyllis and I. The characters are loosely based on Phyllis and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is an over-the-hill hippie who lives in Juneau, Alaska. They're identical twins, by the way.
Okay.
And she lives in Juneau, Alaska. She owns an antique business, and she is the salt of the earth. You know, she'd give the coat off her back to a homeless person and then say, can I run down and get you some shoes?
Mm-hmm.
Godiva, the other twin, is a wealthy, selfish, manipulative widow from Beverly Hills who writes an advice column. Her full name is Godiva Olivia Dubois, and her column is called Ask G period O period D period, which is her initial. And
uh-huh.
then they're aided and abetted. I say that with tongue in cheek because they
right.
don't want any help from their 80-year-old mother and uncle who are former vaudeville magicians. But these elder sleuths just can't resist getting into disguises and going undercover to help their girls. So they have a lot of schemes that backfire. They get into all kinds of hot water. And one of the things we're known for is coming up with very funny character names. And
mm-hmm.
Like in A Corpse in the Soup, part of the book centers around a competition that's kind of like an over-the-top Iron Chef competition.
Okay.
And it's called the Greatest Gourmet Gladiators Tournament. And to give you a little idea of the kind of names we've used, the
uh-huh.
competing chefs are Cesar Romano, the romantic chef,
uh-huh.
Biff Wellington, the aerobic chef who exercises while he's cooking,
uh-huh.
Toulouse Jankowski, the Polish Cajun, and Moishi Matsumoto, the king of kosher sushi.
Now, you know, you brought something up earlier on, and I've got to ask you the question.
Yes.
I wanted to hear everything you were saying, so I didn't want to interrupt. But
okay.
you say that you describe these two sisters, one is the salt of the earth, and one of them is, you know, kind of hell on wheels. And you said they were loosely based on your sister and you, so I've got to ask the obvious question. Which one are you?
Well, unfortunately, I'm Godiva, the manipulative one. And I always qualify this. I say I'm nowhere near as selfish as Godiva is. I definitely
uh-huh.
admit to being manipulative. I don't live in Beverly Hills, but at one time I lived two houses outside the city line. And I don't write an advice column. But I do give a lot of people advice because I'm always asked for advice. Phyllis lived in Juneau for many, many years, did own an antique store, is the salt of the earth, and is an over-the-hill hippie. So we know exactly who Goldie is.
And, that's funny.
You know, the contrast between the two of them, because, of course, they're identical on the outside, but the contrast between the two of them is what makes it so much fun. And then we have based a lot of the characters on composites of the zany family we grew up in, and friends who we had some pretty interesting friends through the years. So, you know, we've combined various characteristics to come up with some of our other characters.
Are the two of you, in fact, identical twins?
No, we're not. We're 5.5 years apart. But one very weird thing has happened since we've been writing together. And by the way, we both were published writers before we started writing together.
I see.
But
uh-huh.
neither one of us had written fiction.
Phyllis
has won several Alaska Press Club awards. She was a journalist, and she did political print for various governors and things like that. I wrote many, many magazine articles, how-to articles, things and so forth, but neither one of us had ever written fiction.
What they call service articles.
Yeah, more or less,
Right.
And so, you know, learning learning to write fiction together was a learning curve for us. But the thing that's happened is that we've gotten this great benefit from writing together, because being that Phyllis moved to Alaska when she was only 20 years old, and we're 5.5 years apart, right about the time we would have become friends as adults, she was thousands of miles away. And our mom was always the conduit. She told us what was going on in each other's lives. But then when Mom had these mini strokes, we came together to solve her medical situation, discovered we really liked each other, have become best friends through our writing, and now when we're together, because she lives in Oregon and I split my time between California and Las Vegas, but when we're together, we are invariably asked if we're twins.
That's funny.
Which is really funny.
I'll tell you something in the same light. I have a brother who's 4 years older, and when I'm trying to think how old we were at the time, I guess I probably was about 17 or 18, and again, obviously, he was 4 years older. And my opinion is that if you, it's we look even less alike now, but even then, if you told somebody that we were brothers, they'd believe you, but you wouldn't have guessed us out of a crowd, right? I mean, it's that's the way it is. But anyway, we were talking to some people, and this young woman asked us, and by the way, in this story, I'm not the one with the best line. she asked us if we were twins, and before I could say anything, my brother said, "Yes, we are." But it was kind of a difficult delivery for our mother. It took 4 years.
Oh, my God, he stole my sister's line. That's one of the things she says. She has two stock answers.
Yeah.
One of them is, if we are, it made medical history because it took my mom 5.5 years to deliver me. And
very
her other
labor,
one is,
yeah.
my sister must look great for her age because I sure as hell don't look older.
Yeah, well, there you go. That's funny. So where did you grow up in California? I assume from what you said you grew up in California.
Right. Well, I lived in Chicago until I was 13 years old. And then just as I was ready to go to high school, my parents gave me the news that we were moving to California. And I grew up in L.A., and lived there really most of my adult life, all of my adult life. Now I split my time between a home in Las Vegas and a home in Marina Del Rey, California, which right near the ocean. You know, so I've got the ocean and the desert. Can't ask for much more than that.
No one will be interested in this except me, probably. But what high school did you go to?
Oh, I went to Fairfax High School.
I see.
And you know, quite a few well-known people have gone to Fairfax. I'm not one of them.
Well, what I was going to say, and people may get this in a minute, but they may not. What I was going to say is, if you went to Fairfax, I should probably say, that's funny, you don't look it. And for those who don't know, Fairfax High School in Los Angeles, it is much less true now, but in the days that we're talking about was something like 95% Jewish.
Yes, yeah. As a matter of fact, when the Jewish holidays would come around, you know, most
yeah.
high schools would send a thing around saying, will you be out for the holidays? Fairfax
right.
would send notes around saying, will you be, no, I'm
Here.
Sorry, they would say, will you be out? In Fairfax, they wanted to know how many people would be out because they needed to keep all the teachers on because 95%
right.
were gone for the Jewish holidays.
Right. When did you graduate high school? I'll tell you why I'm asking you in a second.
A long time
okay,
ago.
Okay,
no,
well,
I'm
the
not
reason.
Shy about my age, and
okay.
so I graduated in 1957.
Okay, well, let me share something with you. A few years after you graduated, the thing with that school was so profoundly more true. That is, the Jewish population was so disproportionate because in those days, folks, people went to high schools in their neighborhoods, you know, and it was, of course, a Jewish neighborhood. But what I was going to tell you is a few years after you finished, they stopped sending that survey question around. They just closed the school on the Jewish holidays. I'm serious.
Oh, did they really? I didn't know
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
you know, I always say I went to Fairfax in the days when they had a bad football team and very high academics.
yeah.
The
yeah.
tables have turned.
yeah, yeah. Among the people who went there, and you'll probably name some others, but among the people who went there was a baseball pitcher for the Los Angeles Dodgers, which if you're an old baseball fan.
Sherry
right.
boys went there.
Yeah, Larry and Norm Sherry, if you're
right.
a baseball fan who knows about old baseball players. I think Alan Sherman went there, for those of you who remember My Son the Folk Singer.
Well,
and or maybe not. But go ahead, who else went there that you were going
oh,
to name?
What was I going to say now? Herb Alpert?
Oh, that's right, of the Tijuana
yeah.
Brass.
Yeah, and there were just Bert Sugarman, who was a producer.
Right, and a boxing promoter.
Yes, yes. I mean, there were so many, but I was going to tell you a funny Alan Sherman one, being that you mentioned him.
Please.
I don't know if he did go to Fairfax
or not. I don't
know
either. He may have been in New York.
He was
in high school.
One of my uncle owned a famous boys camp in Eagle River, Wisconsin. And if you remember mm-hmm. the song Hello Mutter, Hello Fodder,
yeah.
you know,
mm-hmm.
Well, the thing was, he was one of my uncle's counselors. And how can you rhyme with Camp Ojibwa? Granada. But it
That's
was written
right.
about my uncle's camp.
That's very funny. Funny, it's funny that comes up. By the way, we're getting off track a lot.
Yes.
And that's perfectly fine. But for those who don't know, Alan Sherman, before he began his performance career, and he, I'm sure, would readily acknowledge, his singing was not the best. It was the comedy that people listened to him for. But he was originally a television producer.
Oh, I didn't
produced,
know that.
Yeah, he produced the original Gary Moore-hosted game show, I've Got a Secret, when Gary Moore hosted that.
Oh, for heaven's sakes, I had
yeah.
no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's
That's
brilliant as far as satire.
He was, yes. He's been you know, long dead, obviously. He
yeah.
Cigarettes did him in, but never mind that. Anyway, tell us what you're working on now.
Oh, goodness. Have you got a couple of hours? I do have two new books coming out under a pen name. I have
right.
Devil's Dance
mm-hmm.
will be released in August, and The Devil's Due will be released in September. And those are not funny books. Those are pretty serious romantic suspense books.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, I'm writing them under the pen name Arliss Adams
right.
because I'm
mm-hmm.
pretty well known for comedy, you know, as Morgan St.
Sure.
James.
Mm-hmm.
So I was advised to use a pen name for them. But now I'm having fun because I used a picture of myself, oh, maybe 15 or 18 years ago when I had a big mane of auburn hair, and that's Arliss Adams. And
right.
so now I'm out shopping for wigs, you know, so that I can do the signing with Arliss.
There you go.
Before
you go on with that, let me ask you. Let me get back to the Silver Sisters mysteries.
Yes.
The way people could find that would be just going to Amazon.com, for
oh,
example,
absolutely.
And putting in Silver Sisters.
Amazon, or they can go to our publisher's site as well, which is www.lldreamspell.com. But Amazon has all of it, and we're published in every format. We're in paperback, ebook, Kindle, audiobook, CDs, and MP3.
Okay, and before you go on, are you available in other bookstores?
At present, no.
Okay, gotcha. And how have you found publishing in Kindle? I mean, to the extent that you can identify.
Well, I'll tell you, our Kindle sales do very, very well.
That's great.
I'm constantly monitoring Amazon, and, you know, they go up and down. Amazon is really kind of an interesting thing to monitor because one day you're number 27,000, the next day you're number 1,200,000.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's hard to tell, you know, how sales affect it, but I know that we've been building quite a good fan base, and anybody who loves a whodunit with lots of action and snappy dialogue, they're going to like our books. And
yeah, I'm actually going to follow up on that because I'm a mystery freak and I obviously like humor. Not that I can produce it, but I like listening to it. Tell us what Examiner.com is.
Okay, Examiner.com is a very rapidly growing online newspaper, and it's national. They call the reporters examiners, and they have examiners in almost every city. And while we're talking about that, today there was an interview with me on Examiner.com by the Los Angeles Books Examiner, Frank Mundo. And all anybody has to do is go to www.examiner.com. I write for the Las Vegas edition, and I write columns anywhere from 3 to 4 times a week.
Kind of subject?
Okay, on Tuesdays, I spotlight somebody who is in the literary community or an organization or an event. And I've tried to put the spotlight on a lot of local authors in Las Vegas, people in the publishing industry, events that are happening. So that's Tuesday. And then on Thursdays, I've been writing a how-to series that will eventually become a book. And it's lots of writers' tips, techniques, and tricks. And that's been getting a very good following.
Sure.
And when I do how-tos, you know, because that was how I started out writing, I try to write very clear and straightforward, you know, not a lot of mumbo-jumbo. I like to do the same thing that I do in my workshops that I give for writers and presentations I do to organizations and book panels, is I like to give people things that they can act with immediately. You know, they
That's
can
great.
Leave or read the article, take it and say, hey, that's an easy thing to do. I never thought about it that way. And those are pretty much the comments I get on my column is, you
that's
know, thanks so much for pointing that out. And then I've started on Mondays just doing a fun thing with books that have become movies, and I'll take one book that's become a movie and, you know, kind of go through that. And then if anything comes along that interests me, I'll throw up an extra column or two.
Well, that's neat. I write a monthly column for a local, I guess you would call it a lifestyle magazine. A number of months back, we interviewed the editor. The magazine name is Scottsdale Health, and which I commend to all of you, whether you're in Scottsdale or not, not just because of me. It's actually kind of a fun magazine to read. But what I was going to ask you about in terms of Examiner.com, if someone wanted to read your columns, you indicated that this website, which I had heard of but didn't know as much about as you just explained, it's somewhat localized. Could someone find you, or would they have? What would they do to find you?
Oh, very easily.
You know?
Yeah, all they do is go to www.examiner.com, and you can change the cities that you're looking for.
So
if they plug in Las Vegas for the city, or if they just go into the search and put my name in, they'll come up with an entire listing. I think I have over 100 columns in the archive
now.
Wow,
that's great.
And it'll come up with a complete listing of all the columns I've done.
Well, that's really neat. That must be a lot of fun for you besides all of your other projects.
Well, you know what it is? It kind of reverts back to my roots, you know?
Sure.
Because I've always loved writing how-to columns. And as I said, I started out writing how-to columns for a very slick interior design magazine. I was an interior designer at the time. And they approached me about doing articles for them, which I did, and that's how I began writing. So how-tos hold a pretty near and dear place in my heart. Then I'm also working on two more novels. I'm working, besides the Vanishing Act and Vega Silver Sisters, I'm working on one called Anything But Paradise, and the best way I can describe that is 9 to 5 meets the First Wives Club in a government embezzlement fiasco.
Okay.
And Paradise is a federal prison, a fictional federal prison.
And that's written under your Arliss Adams name, correct?
That's under Arliss Adams. And then I'm also writing one called Confessions of a Cougar.
you need to explain to those who don't know, and I assume most people do now, what is a cougar?
Well, after it stopped being a mountain lion, cougar was a term used to describe older women going out with younger men. And this one was actually, it's my confession. This was actually based on some experiences I had on my first trip to England when I was 42. And I met a very nice, nice young man, emphasis on young.
Yeah, I got that. That's the part of the cougar thing.
Right. That
same
was
age, you don't qualify.
Married.
Okay. And, okay, so now you've gotten out of trouble with your husband. You're doing fine.
Yes. Oh, he knows all about it.
Okay, good. No, I'm saying you got out of trouble with your husband by making sure you emphasized that was before I was happily married.
Oh, yes.
Okay. And you have also, the book, the Cougar, Confessions of a Cougar. You're working on that. That's
I'm working on
yet.
That one. Now, I may just do that one as a Kindle experiment and only do it as Kindle to begin with because it's a real fun, light read. A friend of mine and I made this trip, and of course I've fictionalized some of it.
Sure.
But the bones of it were all based on truth. And it was, I don't know how I get into these things, Jeff, but so many things that have happened to me through my life are pretty over the top, you know?
Yeah,
and
I understand.
A lot of the experiences that we had, if I were to tell somebody they were fiction, they'd believe it in a heartbeat. If I told them they were true, they'd look at me like I was nuts.
Right. Have to be making that up.
Yes, exactly.
There is...
It's a fun book to write, and I'm also working on yet another book, a how-to kind of. It's a fun look at how we murder the English language called You Don't Say, and I'm working on that with a collaborator. We write a column for the Sisters in Crime Southern Nevada newsletter, and Sisters in Crime is a literary organization.
Of mystery writers?
Are you familiar with it? It's a national organization. Actually,
I'm familiar only peripherally with the national organization. They have a really great website.
Yeah,
we have a really slick
website, the Southern Nevada one.
Well,
and,
the one that I think is national, as soon as you get to the website, if they're still doing it this way, and if memory serves, it plays the Peter Gunn theme when you get to the website.
I don't think it plays that anymore.
I'm
not sure. But, so they have over 3,400 members, and we're one of the newest chapters in Southern Nevada. And among all these things that I'm doing, I also publish the newsletter called On the Prowl. So Mike Dennis and I have started writing this column for the newsletter called You Don't Say, and we got so much favorable comment on it, we decided to turn it into a book, and we currently have a proposal with a publisher for it.
Good for you. Do you happen to cover the word, one of my pet peeves is the misuse of the word unique.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Okay.
How can
there.
Something be most unique when unique is something of itself? But
one
we also
kind,
do a lot of, redundancies, a misspelling of words, and oxymorons. But it's all done in a real fun, light way. If people were to look up Sisters in Crime Southern Nevada on Meetup, www.meetup.com, under the files section, it's more and then files, the current newsletter is always there.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, and I mean... I don't know how I got into that. I volunteered to do the newsletter, and next thing I knew, I was doing a 20-page newsletter every month.
Yeah.
I guess it's because I don't do anything halfway.
Yeah, right. I was going to say it's not as if you're not busy enough. From the sounds of things, you may be literally working your fingers to the bone.
Well, you know, a lot of my friends ask me what I do with the extra 2 minutes I have every day.
Yeah, because you're working on the third book in the mystery series. You're doing the romantic suspense novels. You're writing a column for Examiner.com, editing the Sisters in Crime newsletter, and you have more or less written the book already on language. So, yeah, I think maybe you're keeping a little busy.
I have some more short stories coming out in anthologies this year.
That's great. And what do you like writing best, I guess, would be the appropriate, though silly sounding question.
I like writing funny, light things. I really do. The Silver Sisters is kind of a conglomerate of talents because, you know, I always say that I have a good sense of humor, and I can write humor well. My sister has an over-the-top, quirky sense of humor, so she puts all the real sizzle on the Silver Sisters. So, unlike when I write with other writers, when I send my things to Phyllis, because I will craft the chapters, and Phyllis is a trained editor, so she edits and massages and, you know, does all of that.
Adds here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't do very much editing of my own work when I send it to Phyllis, because I know she's going to edit it anyway. And so, you know, some of the, I might say, you know, he pointed at Godiva, and she'll have him waving a wonton in the air or something.
Yeah. Well, listen, that's great. I mean, it, obviously, with both of you doing these things, it enhances one another, and they've been selling well, and you keep on going. So, obviously, the formula is working.
Yeah, well, Vanishing Act in Vegas is going to be a real fun one, too, because we managed to work in a lot of kind of typical old Las Vegas stuff, like the Liberace Museum, and we've got them going to Boulder City, and, you know, there's some real fun things in there, and of course we made Flossie and Sterling old friends of Lee Liberace.
Sure.
So that we could get some good banter in there.
Work something in. That's great. Yeah, well, that's something, frankly, I'm going to look up, is the Silver Sisters, because that sounds like
Laugh. You know, when we first started writing them, we thought they would be strictly chick lit, you know, books for women. We've had so many men tell us how much they like them, and here's kind of an interesting comment. They say, with so much strife and aggravation and everything else going on in the world, it's really great to be able to just sit back and laugh your head off for a while.
Yeah, we've got about 2 minutes left,
but
I have to tell you something in that context. For one of the book clubs I belong to, they recommended a book, which, by the way, in case anyone's listening, I am not recommending. It's called This Is How, and it's written by M.J. Hyland. I don't know if you've ever heard of the book. It was kind of a semi-hit, but it is so dark and so heavy. It's a story about a guy who kind of accidentally kills somebody and ends up in jail.
Ooh.
And it talks about his life in jail. It's fiction. It's not, you know, and it's in England. And it's just so, you know, it's very tough to get through. I mean, it's not difficult to read, but it's very difficult to force yourself to get through. Who needs that?
Well, like my romantic suspense books, they have some couple of moments that are real, you know, oh my God moments in them. But it's balanced out with some tender love and rebirth, and when I say rebirth, a girl whose life has been destroyed rebuilds it and survives and prevails. And so, you know, it's got the rah-rah stuff in it, too, because I think having it all be doom and gloom, it's too depressing.
Not fun to read. Not fun to write either. Anyway, we are flat out of time. We've got less than a minute left. No, but everybody who's listening, please look up Morgan St. James, look up the Silver Sisters Mysteries on Amazon, and go see her column on Examiner.com. Anything else? Morgan St. James -author.com.
Yeah.
Be a great way to find her work, and you'll have a pleasure doing it. Morgan, thanks very much. We'll talk again.
Well, thanks so much for having me as your guest, Jeff.
My pleasure. When the next book comes out, let me know. We'll get you back on.
Oh, I definitely will. That's August.
Okay, well, that's fine. We'll talk at the end of August. Thank you very much.
Okay, great.
You take care. Thanks. It's been a delight.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. And that leaves us with just a few seconds to say thank you all for joining us. Hope you join us next week. We will have Larry Hancock with us. And I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Morgan St. James, at least as much as I did. Have a great time. Thank you for joining us, and until next week, persevere.